This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you need help bringing out the best in your pet's behavior, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And as always, we have another special topic to share. And what will it be this time, Patricia?
Well, you know, we've talked a lot lately about what's going on in the minds of other animals. Mm-hmm. It's a hot topic in science right now. And it seems like one fascinating discovery after another keeps unfolding. And the latest we're going to talk about today, it has to do with rats and their ability to understand what they know and what they don't know.
Do they know what we know, what they know and don't know?
Right. Yes, right.
Wow.
Of course. Yes.
Okay.
You got it, Larry.
We'll also talk to a researcher and author about the wild elephant herds of Africa. She has some ideas about their communication systems, and she'll be here a little later on to tell us about them. For now, we are ready to take some calls, and let's take our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Donna, and I'm calling from Stettin, Alaska.
Donna, thank you so much for calling. What is on your mind?
Well, I live in the growing region of Alaska where the summers are long and warm, and so I try to start my spring garden in my sunroom every year from seeds and pots, and last year was my first year, and my cat tore up every single pot completely.
Aww.
So I tried again this year, and I tried putting it up several feet high on a table and filling the table completely with pots so there was no landing pad for her to land on.
Right.
And she's torn through all the pots yet again. So I'm wondering if there's any way to, like, classically train a cat. She's not going to the bathroom in the pots. She's just tearing them up or hanging out and laying in them.
And just enjoying her little spot of a little early
her little
spring.
Piece of the
I
earth.
Guess her little spot of earth. She gets lots of outside time. I mean, we live on a lot of land, and so she spends most of her day outside. But if she comes in, she jumps in the pot.
That beautiful sunroom and that warm soil.
Yeah.
I think that's the attractant.
The warmth?
Yeah.
And the sun, and lying on the good earth. And there are some ideas. And they're mostly about making it not as much fun for her. But there is a positive idea there, too. Let me give you that one first.
Okay.
A lot of cats, I don't know if she does this much, but a lot of cats love to chew on vegetation. So we can get out down here outside, as you Alaskans call it, in the lower 48, we can get cat grass. You can just buy it at the market or in a big pet store. So I don't know if that's available. I'll bet it would be in Anchorage, and I'm guessing you're in the Matanuska Valley, the way you describe it.
Yes.
So in a big pet store, you can usually buy cat grass, and I give that to my cat during winter when there's nothing available for her here in Wisconsin to eat. So that might help a little bit if you basically bought something that was good for her. You could maybe even grow your own.
Sounds like you got
a great green thumb, right?
Just
grow some grass for her, put it in another place. The other ideas have to do with making it not so much fun to be up on top of all of those pots. So what you might want to do is use scent, because there are a lot of smells that are aversive to cats. So you can try spraying the area with citronella or a citrus type of oil, aerosol kind of oil-based product. A lot of cats don't like that smell. Of course, they don't read the books, and so you might have the cat who's like, oh, I love the smell of oranges. But try citronella. That's a scent that is quite attractive to us, but usually not to cats, and it should not hurt your plants. But so I think I'd think about getting your cat. You might want to put another little table up or in the sunroom that's the cat's area, and then spray the other area so your cat gets what she wants, and you get what you want.
Absolutely.
Great idea. I'll try that.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Patricia, at about this time last week, we took an email question from Paul in Menasha, Wisconsin, who wonders what his turtles are up to when they circle around each other and quiver their front arms. You thought it might be a courting ritual or maybe a display of aggression, but you weren't sure. Did you research this?
I did. I called some reptilian experts in reptilian behavior, and bless their hearts, they immediately said, "Oh, that sounds like two males." That he said, if they were quivering their front legs, particularly if they were facing each other and quivering their front legs, it sounds very much like aggressive displays between two males. So no courtship. No baby turtles, no turtle eggs.
Just the opposite.
Just two males trying to maintain territory.
And if somebody has an email question for us, how do they email us?
We love to hear from you. We get great ideas from you, too. So please contact us by sending an email to pets@wpr.org.
And again, the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Diana. And I'm from Hedgesville, West Virginia.
Thanks for calling, Diana. What's on your mind?
I have a question for Tricia about combining pets in the home. We have an 11-year-old African gray parrot. She is not one of those right-on-your-shoulder, lovey-huggy, on-the-couch parrots. Her main domain, she's on and in her cage, but she is not clipped, and sometimes she does fly off.
Mm-hmm.
Retirement and loneliness got the better of me, and I Saturday brought home 5-pound Chihuahua mix from the Humane Society, and I was wondering if you had some recommendations on quality things to do to integrate the pup into the home. The only thing I have done so far is I hold the puppy at the cage when she's out, not close enough for them to be able to touch each other, and just kind of say, how do you do? This is puppy, this is birdie, several times a day. That has gone pretty well.
Good. And I would do a couple of other things. For people, by the way, who don't have African grays or aren't familiar with them, the best description I've ever heard of an African gray, which is a large, extremely intelligent, and very territorial parrot, is that they are a representation of a hybrid between a 2-year-old child and an alien. They're very, very smart, and they can be very aggressive, and they're large parrots, and that beak could break your finger. So I have this vision of this poor little Chihuahua as sort of a prey item.
Well, that's what I was envisioning, the parrot flying off with the Chihuahua.
Right. Well, not quite hawks, but
believe it or not, the other day I had to fuss the puppy yesterday because he would not stop biting me, and he hurt. He really hurt.
Sure.
And I fussed a little loud and put him in his little carrier for a while.
Uh-huh.
And I went over and touched her, and she struck me on the finger and drew blood for the first time in years. And I think she was giving me the Dickens because I gave the pup the Dickens.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's one possibility. She could have also just been sort of generally aroused by the general arousal. And we don't want that. I don't want you getting carried away by your parrot either. Here are a couple things you can do. One is, adding on to what you're already doing, is I would teach Birdie that every time she looks at your little dog, she gets a treat. So what's your dog's name?
We haven't totally decided, but I think it's going to wind up being Bear.
Bear.
Yeah, there is a story behind that.
Bear the Chihuahua. Okay. So I want you to say, Birdie, where's Bear? And then every time Birdie looks at your little dog, give the parrot a treat. And do that like 8 times in a row, maybe 3 or 4 times a day. And so what you're hopefully going to do is you're going to classically condition your parrot to feel good every time she sees the dog. You certainly want to discourage any kind of aggressive behavior. And I'm concerned about that bite to you. What you might want to do is be sure to discipline your dog using very low speech. Don't get loud, because loud can arouse parrots, and parrots love drama. And rather than
make a big fuss out of it.
I love your fuss word, by the way. We all fuss a bit to our dogs, too. But anyway, try those things, and then let us know how it's going.
And thank you very much for calling. Good luck. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Gabriel in Fredericksburg.
Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I bet. All right. What can we do for you?
I have a little baby pug, and he's about 3 or 3.5 months old now, but he's starting to teethe, and I can't get him to stop chewing on people's hands and bare feet and stuff like that.
And that gets tiresome after a while, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I've tried using the spraying water from a spray bottle and talking to him, but mm-hmm. I don't want to hit him or anything like that fold-up newspaper or anything like that. I just can't think of what to do.
Yeah, and good for you for not wanting to use your hand or a newspaper or something. What that seems to do is it teaches a dog to be afraid of your hand. So when you reach towards the dog, they can run away or they can sometimes even snap at you. So, so you're really good for you for wanting to use a different method. I would try my favorite method, which is the old Yelp routine. I would try making a sound basically like a seal is the best way I can describe it. It sounds like AWRP. Oh! Or you can just say ouch, but you want it to bolt out of your mouth. Ouch! Really fast like that.
Ouch!
Ouch! Good. Because it gets attention that way. And that's what you want to do. You want to get your dog's attention and sort of startle him or her so that she or he stops what they were doing for just a second and looks at you like, what? And then here's the key. This is the second part is what makes it work. If you don't do the second part, it's not going to work. As soon as your dog looks at you, and I mean the microsecond your dog looks at you, you're going to go get a toy and replace your hand or your foot with that toy. So it's basically don't play with that, play with this. With some dogs, what you want to do is just yelp and then just withdraw your attention. Just, okay, play session over. So this is the age to start getting this started. You know, they come having played that way with their litter mates. That's how they grow up playing. And they think that they don't know that they shouldn't play with you like that. So we have to teach them, one, that we don't have fur on our skin. We're very delicate little things. Oh, that hurts. And teach them basically you don't play with humans that way. You play with humans with an object. So emphasize the object play and yelp whenever you're the toy. Let us know how it goes.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll get inside the mind of a rat and find out if it's aware of its own knowledge. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Each week, Patricia and Larry give you great advice that helps you deal with your pet's behavior. Do you want to learn more about the advice you heard or find out about a guest featured on the show? Well, you can find all that information and more by logging on to our website at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and it's time for this week's topic. And Tricia, we've talked a lot lately about what's going on in the minds of other animals, and you have some research to share about rats.
That's right, I do. There's a new study by Foote and Crystal, published in Current Biology, that looks at what's called metacognition, or an animal's ability to think about thinking. You know, another way to put it is to ask, does an animal know what it knows?
And how, pray tell, do they test that?
That was a good question. Well, this study is really elegant. I really like it. The rats were asked to discriminate between two sounds of different lengths. So in the easy form of this test, one was about 2 seconds long and the other sound was about 8 seconds long. But here's the catch. If the rats were right, if they guessed right, long versus short, they got 6 pellets of food. If they were wrong, they got no pellets of food. But if they chose to not make a guess at all, if they sort of held them, you know when to hold,
mm-hmm.
they got 3 pellets of food.
So the worst thing they could do was guess wrong then. What did the rats end up doing?
Well, when the sounds were as different as 2 seconds versus 8 seconds, a real simple kind of test, they guessed right almost every time, didn't have any problems. But very quickly, the researchers started making the task more difficult. So, for example, the sounds the rats had to discriminate between could be 4 seconds versus 5 seconds, or 4.5 seconds versus 4.3 seconds.
Oh.
And so the rats had a much higher likelihood of being wrong. And as a result, what they did is they strategically started declining to answer at all.
So, in other words, They knew when they'd get food, and they knew when they wouldn't. So I guess you could say they knew what they knew.
They knew what they knew. That's right. Metacognition at its finest. You know, it was better. If they weren't sure of the answer, they were better to make a choice to not guess. And that's just what they did.
That's interesting. But does everybody agree that these tests are really proof that these rats and other animals are aware of their knowledge?
Oh, this is science. Of course not. No, not everybody agrees with this. There's an argument that an individual does not have to be consciously aware of its own knowledge to make these kind of decisions. A lot of decisions can be unconscious. And, you know, we can learn a lot without actually being aware of it. You can even program computers to know what they know and and know what they don't know. And this kind of unconscious knowledge and decision-making is actually the basis for a lot of television commercials, right? You know? So it's certainly true that we need to be cautious. But it's also true that there's an awful lot of research now that suggests that there just isn't as much separating the minds of humans and other animals as many people would like to think.
And you know, my wife often says that I walk around half conscious.
Well, I'm not going to touch that, Mueller. I'm staying right on the rats.
Man. Well, if you need help understanding what's going on in your animal's mind, you can give us a call. And here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great. Who are we speaking with?
Mike from Duluth, Minnesota.
Mike, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, we have a few cats, and three of them are girls. And about maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, our one cat had a litter that was given away, and then the other two had litters. Now, recently, the one that one didn't have the litter anymore, she's been taking the cats and moving them around and taking care of them herself, and just she keeps bringing them out of the room and stuff like that from the other one. So we're not sure if that is something that's normal when you have a group of cats, or is there something we can do to keep her from doing it, or is she just going to do it because that's her nature?
She's going to do it probably because she still is flooded with those hormones that she had that caused her to want to be so maternal. That sounds like maternal behavior, is that she's as if she's carrying her kittens around and taking care of them. How old were the kittens when they left?
About 6 weeks.
Okay. And so she's probably just continuing with that process. In a lot of cats, it will go away.
Was it maybe because we took them away too early? Or?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, because there's not as much research as I wish there was on when is the, quote, right age to take kittens away. And, you know, traditionally 6 weeks has been an age a lot of people do. Any younger than that, it can be really serious problems. But, you know, based on some of the research I've seen, I think cats might want to go a bit later.
Okay.
With dogs now, as the years go on, people are starting to push the age up a little bit. With dogs, they're talking more about 8 weeks, 8, 9 weeks. And with kittens, I would say at least around there. So ideally, you know.
8 weeks,
maybe. The reason why we had gotten rid of them at the time, because they were starting to eat the hard food and eating food other than their mom, you know. So we thought, well, they must be ready. You know, they're all bouncing around. It was right close to Easter. So everyone was calling us, going, we have kitties, you know, kitties, you know. So,
well, you know, you bring up such an interesting point, and I'm really glad you brought it up, because it used to be we thought that, well, if they're weaned such that they can eat dry food, then or non, you know, something besides mother's milk, then they're ready to go. And actually, what we've learned relatively recently is that there are other things they actually need to get from their mom besides milk. And some of those things include training in terms of emotional control, you know, sort of managing their own emotions and managing frustration. So next time, you might want to think about, you know, if you're going to breed again. Obviously, I'm presuming that you know where these kittens are going to go, because there's so many cats out there that don't have homes. But
we have people on reserve already, but we just want to make sure we wait long enough this time before they go.
I would wait. I would wait a little bit longer. And I also would encourage you to think about, you have three cats. It sounds like they're all the potential of having bred. There's so many cats out there. So one thing you might want to think about is it time to spay Maggie or Fluffy or, you know,
oh, yes,
whoever?
Well, we have six kids combined between me and my wife, so things have been pretty tight money-wise.
Got
so it's
it.
Been kind of hard to find a good price, even though I know now, you know, we've had our definitely our lots of kittens, you know, so it's getting the money saved and getting them done right. Now, do you usually have to get them the shots first before you do that, or is it better just to get them spayed?
I would definitely talk to your veterinarian, but the vaccinations that you normally get are separate from the spay procedure. And, you know, there are some places that have funds for low-cost. Some of the shelters have low-cost spay-neuter programs,
mm-hmm.
and I'd definitely look into that.
Yeah.
Because your, you know, your motives are really good and your intentions are good, and surely there's some money out there. You got enough to if you got six kids, you got plenty to spend your money on already, right?
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, our number. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Diana from Franklin.
Diana, Franklin,
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. All right. Thank you very much for calling. And what can we do for you? How can we help?
Well, I have a shepherd mix that we adopted from the Humane Society, and he's about 7 years old. We had him when he was about 10 months old. But in the whole time we've had him, I've never had a good vet visit.
Ooh.
It's always been very traumatic. He's a sweet dog. He's well-behaved. I've taken him to behavior classes, and he graduated second in his class.
Oh, good boy.
But it's so traumatic at the vet. He's just scared. You know, he sheds hair,
aww.
He defecates, he bites, you know, I have to muzzle him, and it's just very traumatic.
Oh, yeah. That's so tough, isn't it? Because you want to be a great, responsible dog owner, and your dog needs medical care, and, you know, most of us really like our vets, and we don't want them traumatized and bitten either, right?
No.
So there are a couple things you can do. One of the simplest things to do is to talk to your veterinarian. This is very much something between you and your veterinarian. But there are some medications you can give a dog in advance. Once you get to the vet clinic, it's too late. But say 2 hours or so before you go to the vet clinic, you could give your dog some kind of anti-anxiety medication. But this is something you might want to talk to your veterinarian about. And most vets, as long as they feel that it's indicated in terms of the health of your particular animal, then they're perfectly comfortable doing that because it makes everything easier for everybody. So that's one thing to think about that doesn't take a lot of training and conditioning. The other possibility is there are some vets still who do house calls, and a lot of dogs become conditioned at the vet clinic. So there are procedures you can do at home on the living room floor that you can't do in the vet clinic because the dog has become so conditioned to be terrified and aroused and defensive once you get into all those smells and it's like, oh, no, this is a vet clinic. I can tell.
Well, he knows the minute I'm in the car taking him that that's where he's going. I mean, it's like he can tell that from any other taking him any other place. He knows that he's going to the vet.
Isn't that interesting?
Yep. He's probably watching your face or something.
You know,
there may be something about what you do that tips him off.
And wouldn't it be fun to know? It's
yeah.
just so interesting. The subtlest of signals they can pick up on. They do seem to know these things. And there's some, I'm not a believer in mind reading necessarily. I think, like Larry said, there's some subtle signal. So one possibility is having the vet come to you. Another possibility is going to the vets when you don't have to go to the vets is going to the vets so your dog knows, based on whatever reason, we're going to the vets. But you just drive to the vet clinic, you sit in the parking lot, and you get out your paperback novel. You know, you're reading your mystery novel, and you sit in the parking lot for an hour, give your dog some treats, and then drive home. So just going to the vet clinic is not as scary. So that's another thing you could do. You could also try teaching him it's okay to have a muzzle on, honey. It's just going to make the procedures go faster and less stressful and more easily. It's not cruel to put a muzzle on a dog. So those are a bunch of ideas. I could give you five more, but why don't you try those and then get back to us? You take some aspirin, call us in the morning.
Call
no,
me in the morning.
No, get back to us and let us know how it's going.
And thanks very much for calling. Good luck. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll explore the secret sense of the wild elephant herds of Africa. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Even man's best friend has a fault or two, so bring out the best in your pet with advice from Patricia's dog training books. Whether you need help with a multi-dog household or you're feeling guilty about leaving your pet home alone, you can find the information you need online. For a selection of books and training guides available for purchase, call the radio store at 800-747-7444 or log on to our website, callingallpets.org.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Caitlin O'Connell to the program. Caitlin's a research associate at Stanford University in the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. And she's the author of the new book, The Elephant's Secret Sense, The Hidden Life of the Wild Herds of Africa. Caitlin, welcome to the program.
Hello. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What is the secret sense that you say elephants have?
Well, very simply, it's that they can feel vibrations through their feet.
Well, tell us more about elephants sensing some of those low-frequency vocalizations they make, not just through the air, but through their feet. Is that right?
Yes. So elephants create some very low-frequency vocalizations along with the trumpeting and roaring that you can also hear. They create a rumble sound that's at about 20 hertz. And this sound is created so powerfully by the elephant that it actually hits the earth, couples with the earth, and becomes the surface of the earth like a ripple. It's like tossing a stone into water and seeing that surface ripple, or seeing the aftermath of an earthquake when high-amplitude surface waves come and break up bridges and parking lots. That's essentially the same thing that elephants are doing when they vocalize with these low-frequency rumbles. And other elephants can then interpret those rumbles as a vocalization. They feel that vibration in their feet, and they respond to it as if they're responding to a vocalization.
Caitlin, how did you realize that elephants had this ability?
I guess it took some time to notice this. It was very subtle at first, but it really took being out at a couple of waterholes in Natasha National Park for weeks at a time and really see that there was a pattern emerging. One thing about elephants is that they're very slow and deliberate, but if you watch them for long enough, you realize that there's a long arc of behavior where our behavior happens very quickly, so our time scales are different. And once I adjusted my time scale, I could see that elephants were freezing and shifting forward on their front feet, and then right before the arrival of another herd or some kind of seismic event, and they wouldn't be scanning with their ears like they would if they were listening to something in the air. It was clear that they were focusing on the ground. And this idea had come from, I had just gotten a master's in seismic communication in insects, and the insects that I studied did the same thing. When they were expecting to feel something in the ground from another insect, they would press their feet down, lean forward, and sometimes lift a foot off the ground, which would facilitate localizing. But I was just so surprised to see that the elephants were doing the same thing. And it took a pattern emerged by continually seeing a group of them freezing, leaning forward, and keeping their ears flat at their sides. And this would always be right before some kind of seismic event. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I wonder if these guys are also feeling vibrations through the ground. This is incredible. And it took me a long time to show it, but that first moment of eureka was really exciting.
How far can these seismic waves travel? How far away can animals detect these rhythms?
Well, it depends on the animal, and we're trying to understand how sensitive the elephant's feet are by training an elephant at the Oakland Zoo to respond to vibrations that are played through a metal plate that she's standing on. And so far, we see that she's more sensitive than we are, but we haven't gotten to a threshold yet because she keeps getting better and better now that she learns what the game is all about, she gets better at so her threshold keeps reducing. Now, the other thing we're looking at is how far away can the vocalization itself travel in the ground and be available for another elephant to detect. And that, our current estimate is about 2 to 4 kilometers, just like the outer limit for airborne sounds in a normal atmosphere. Now, airborne sounds can travel out to about 10 kilometers under special conditions. They're called inversion conditions. But then there's an outer limit to how far airborne sounds travel. They refract back into the atmosphere after 10 kilometers. Whereas theoretically, these groundborne waves don't have an outer limit. And so we still need to understand how far away these sounds can propagate in the ground. And we don't have a good answer for that yet. And it's partly because in the geophysics world, seismologists, when they're measuring earthquakes, they're really interested in a different kind of wave, the P wave. It's a much more fast-acting wave that travels in the ground rather than on the surface of the ground. And they really look at those surface waves as noise, and they filter them out of their data sets. So geophysicists have really data sets on long-distance travel of body waves, but not these kind of surface waves. So we're trying to recreate long-distance experiments to really understand in the far field how far these signals go in the ground.
I'm trying to figure out how these sounds get into the Earth.
Into the ground.
Yeah. Do you have data on if you broadcast a sound through the air, how it impacts on the ground, or does it move through the animal's feet when it's produced? That's the big question I have.
Well, it's a good question. Essentially, the wave is going to travel in the same way once it enters the ground. And it's very difficult to tease that apart in a low-frequency signal because if you put sensors all over the elephant and around the ground in front of it, the wave is so powerful, it's about 120 decibels at the source, that it'll be really hard to localize where the most energy is coming into the ground. We may be able to put pressure sensors on the ground and see where if more of it's coming through the feet rather than the earth in front of the elephant. Now, we suspect that it's probably going through the feet of the elephant because they have this very dense fat under their toes, and it's like acoustic fat, like the melon in the dolphin or other marine mammals have this special fat that helps couple a signal from one medium to another kind of medium. So this would be from the fat into the ground. And it would just be a much easier way for the sounds to get there because the elephant is so heavy, so you've got the weight pressed down on the earth, which is really an elastic, flexible medium, and then you have this dense fat that helps transmit the waves into the ground. So to me, it makes more sense and more conservation of energy if the sounds were to actually go from the feet into the ground rather than around the elephant and into the ground. But both things are probably happening, but I think more energy would go through the feet.
Interesting. Where did you do your original studies on these elephants?
I started this work in Namibia, which is just above South Africa on the west coast. This whole thing started because they wanted me to help farmers keep elephants out of their crops. When I first went to Africa, I had no idea that elephants are a real problem for farmers. They'll come into their fields and they could eat a whole night's worth of food, a whole year's worth of food in one night. And it's a real crisis for these subsistence farmers. And so I was looking for ways to try and help keep elephants away from these areas. And that's where I started to record vocalizations and look for alarm-type vocalizations to see if we could use alarm calls to keep elephants away from an area rather than having them get shot or hurt by any kind of conflict with farmers.
That part of your book is so interesting. It's really riveting to read about these conflicts between animals and people who, as you say, are basically subsistence farmers. How did the project go? Tell us about some of the successes you had, maybe some of the challenges.
As I've been in the country now working on this problem for the past 15 years, I lived in the Caprivi region for 3, which is the basis of some of the book, and then every summer go back to Etosha National Park, June and July, and ask different aspects of this problem, different questions. And one of the things that's happening over time, Namibia has some very progressive conservancy policies, and the elephant population is growing in some areas, and people are very supportive of elephants because of these conservancy policies, but yet they're also moving into areas that they never were before. Right now, it's really in the commercial farming areas, which changes the problem. They're much bigger areas. They're going into the water installations rather than necessarily eating crops. So these commercial farmers, it's a little more hopeful in a way that they have more resources to deal with the problem. They have vehicles. They could go out to the outer areas of their 10,000-hectare farm, let's say. And so we're looking at ways to set up, based on elephant footfall patterns, set up a string of geophones, which are like microphones, but they're in the ground, and they could sense the footfalls of elephants. Maybe set up an alarm system where the farmers would be able to know that elephants are coming or that they're in the area and have more time to respond, more time to try and chase the elephants out. So there's, you know, our system has evolved based on the socio-economic, how the problem has changed over time.
You spent a couple of months every year, as you just said, observing animals. What would you want our listeners to know? What was the most interesting thing about the social behavior of the elephants' herds that you studied?
One of the most startling things that I've discovered in the last few years of really focusing on elephant bull society is that elephant bulls are incredibly affectionate with each other, and bonding appears to be a very important part of their social lives. Bulls have always been thought to be solitary or maybe travel in small groups but then break up and be solitary again. But what we're finding at our site is that elephant bulls have very strong bonds. And they're even, for whatever reason at our site, they're much more affectionate with each other than the females are. And so what we've sort of noticed over time is that it looks as if elephants behave differently depending on their environment. So, for example, some of my colleagues that study elephants in Kenya and in Amboseli National Park, water is really ubiquitous. It's everywhere, so there's no reason to compete for it. At our site, our study site in Natasha National Park, water is a very restricted resource, and that creates a way for us to measure dominance. So we've been looking at dominance hierarchies in this bull society and seeing what the pecking order is and who the great mentors are and who the bullies are. And it's just such an exciting and special window into this society that people haven't really had access to in elephants. You know, there's been some wonderful studies done in the primate world, but now to be able to show dominance and mentoring and what the effect of hormones and testosterone on behavior has been really exciting.
And how are you've been studying these herds for 10, 12 years. How are these herds doing?
In this park, they're doing very well. It's a big question across Africa and Asia. And I think the problem for elephants is that basically the problem is different everywhere you go. And in our area, it's more of a problem that there's lots of elephants rather than too few. And how do you manage, how do you juggle the competition for land between farmers and elephants? And I think with this idea that farmers can actually own the revenue that comes in from elephants, where that used to not be the case. Wildlife was always owned by the government, and Namibia is changing that policy. That is really encouraging more people to look at wildlife as a resource rather than just as a pest that they don't get anything from.
Caitlin, thank you very much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Caitlin O'Connell is the author of The Elephant's Secret Sense, The Hidden Life of the Wild Herds of Africa. She joined us today from her home in San Diego, California. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next, with your chance to win a copy of Caitlin's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
CallingAllPets.org is your portal to more animal advice. Log on today to listen to past shows, browse our pet tip archive, submit email questions, and find out when Tricia will be in a town near you. You can also browse our featured authors and experts for more information about animal behavior. Visit CallingAllPets.org today.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. If you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call at the usual number, 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and a winner will be selected at random to win a copy of The Elephant's Secret Sense by Caitlin O'Connell. And here's today's question. In her book, Caitlin points out that many mammals are equipped to detect seismic cues similar to the way that elephants detect them. Primates, for example, have vibration-detecting cells found primarily in the lips, the hands, the feet, and the muscle lining, the intestine. In elephants, these special cells are not only found in the foot, they are also found in another part of the body. Where else do elephants have a high concentration of these special vibration-detecting cells? So, if you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413 and check out our website in about a week to find out the answer. We'll have it posted at callingallpets.org. And if you'd like to join in, here's that number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi there. My name is Tina, and I'm calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Tina, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a problem with my four-month-old kitten, who is wonderful, by the way, but very playful. And the problem is that I also have two-year-old twins. Most of the time, they're very good together. They, you know, they can play together and everything's fine. But every once in a while, you know, one of my girls will be like running down the hallway past the kitten or something like that, and the kitten will pounce at the girl's leg as they're running by. You know, the girls aren't actually coming up to touch the kitten, so there's nothing I can do to train the girls.
Not to play. You're just running in the house. Yeah, you can't
say
no running.
We have heard this before.
Yeah.
This is not unusual behavior, is it, Patricia, or is it?
No, it's not. I'm wondering if Larry had this problem when he had a two-year-old and some cats in the house. You're absolutely right that you can't tell your little girls you can't run in the house. Although I have to admit, you know, my daddy wouldn't let me run in the house. Somehow lived through it. But you're right that this is a bit of a quandary because you also have, you know, you also can't tell a little four-month-old kitten that it needs to have such emotional control that it sits while the kids run by. But what you can do, and this is why you're calling, is there are some ideas that we have for you about conditioning your kitten to respond differently. And I think that's probably what I'd try. I would ask the girls to try not running by the cat if they see the cat, for example. Now, you know, this is going to be semi-successful here. But I would also start working on the cat. And you can make this a game with your girls. Is you're going to get yourself loaded up with some great little food treats that are you can cut into little pieces that your cat really loves. You can use real meat, anything really healthy for the cat. My cat loves cantaloupe. Who knew? You know, whatever works, whatever your cat's willing to work for. Got a lot of little pieces of it. What you're going to do is you're going to ask your girls not to run right by the kitten. You're going to ask them to walk by. And if the cat stays where she is, she's just sort of seated or lying down, you're going to give her a little treat. Maybe even if she turns and looks at you, maybe you're a little bit behind the cat. So the child goes by and the cat turns and looks at you and gets a treat. And then gradually what you're going to do is you're going to ask your kids to move by faster and faster and faster. Now, this is over a period of like a month, you know, so this is not in like one session. This is probably 45 sessions. And you're going to teach the cat, in other words, a different response, an incompatible response, in which if the cat learns that when the little girls run, the cat turns around and looks behind herself, something good will happen. then you've eliminated the problem. You can also use play. The cat turns the other way, away from the little girls, and you can get out your little fishing pole toy and teach the cat to play with that.
And as a matter of fact, we received a pet tip about that very thing from Sue Ellen in El Dorado, Arkansas. She has a cat named Angora Louise, and the cat started chasing her around the house and lunging at her legs for no apparent reason, sort of like what we're hearing from Tina. And around the time that her cat started doing this, she read an article in Cat Fancy magazine that said that cats who live without other feline companions tend to do this a lot. Well, Sue Ellen has no other cats, so she decided to take the place of another cat by spending more play time with Angora instead of just cuddle time. She bought some feathered balls on a fishing pole and laser lights for floor chasing, as well as a battery-operated crazy ball that she and the cat would chase on the floor, round and around the house. They'd go at least a couple of times a day. And Sue says she was able to decrease the frequency of this intensive play after a couple of weeks, though they continued to play these games for years. And all of this interaction seemed to fix her cat's aggressive behavior. No more attacks, no more unexpected bites.
And that's,
so that's another way.
Yeah, and that's great. And that's basically what that's doing, is giving the cat what it needs. That's a great piece of advice, because cats, most of this pouncing and biting, it's play behavior. And cats can get play and predation all very mixed up. It's very murky in a cat's mind, as best we can tell. So teaching a cat what to chase and how to play appropriately, especially as a four-month-old kitten, is a great idea. So nicely timed. Thank you so much for sending that.
And Tina, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And again, on sending in a pet tip, how do we do that?
We love hearing from you. And it's easy. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And again, the number to call if you would like to join in is 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hi, you're at Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Julie, and I'm in Annapolis, Maryland, with my really terrific cockapoo that we adopted from the SPCA a while back.
Cool.
He's a good-sized guy, I think about 5 or 6 years old, and he's really been a terrific addition to the family. But he has one really annoying behavior that we'd like to try to find a way to modify. He barks if anybody comes onto our property or up to the front door especially, which in and of itself is not a problem, but I'd like to find a way to tell him to stop, because we go through this ritual where I have to open the door and he greets whoever's there and they have to pet him and then he'll stop and he's fine. But like, if I'm on the phone and I can't get to the door, well, I'm hoping that nobody comes to the door while I'm on the phone with you, because I won't be able to continue the conversation. Is there some way I can train him so that I can tell him to stop and he'll stop?
There is. And, you know, I was actually motivated to find this, I would say, about 20 years ago myself, when I was on the phone with a client and said, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. My dogs are barking.
Yeah.
and hung up and thought,
That's a great advertisement.
That was a really impressive thing for a certified applied animal behavior. Just, I guess I better get a handle on this. So, yeah, so I actually work with my own dogs and created a training paradigm that I've suggested to lots of people, and a lot of people have found it very, very helpful. So here's just one idea. Basically, if you have a dog who barks predictably, as you do, and as I did, somebody pulled up, drove up the driveway, knocked on the door, what you can do is you can create a situation where the triggers that cause the barking occur without a real visitor. So in other words, you can go to the doorbell, for example, and you can ring your own doorbell.
Right.
But you're prepared for this. You're ready for a training session. So it means you have treats, you got your mind on your dog, you know, you're not having to do something else. There aren't real visitors there. You don't have to deal with them. So what you're going to do is you're going to go to the doorbell and ring it. And your dog's going to bark, 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 bark. And
yeah,
after,
he definitely will.
Yeah, right. Right, this is
no
easy,
problem
right?
There.
This part is easy. You've got this part mastered already. But so you're going to take some tasty little treat, and I mean tasty, okay? I'm talking high value here. And while your dog is barking, you're going to move that treat right to within a third of an inch of his nose. And as you do that, as your hand goes down, you're going to say, that's enough. And I want you to say it that way. Have your voice drop, Larry.
That's enough.
Yes.
I can do that.
Larry's voice is best, so if you can get Larry to stand in your entryway,
I'll record it and send it.
Highly recommend you use Larry's voice, but so that's enough. And then then that treat's going to get to your dog's nose right after you say that, and your dog is going to be distracted by the smell of the treat and be like, oh, barking? I wasn't barking. What? What's that? And then your dog's quiet for like 2 seconds. And then you use that treat to lure your dog in the other direction. So now we're not facing towards the door. We're facing away from the door. You say, good dog, and give your dog the treat. So he's only been quiet for like, oh, a second. But he was quiet after you said enough, and then he got reinforced for it. So that's step one. Now, there are many steps between step one and a dog who, when you're on the phone 40 yards away, you can just say enough when there's somebody at the door. The steps are in between are to ask the dog to stay quiet longer and longer. Sometimes you can give them something else to do to keep them busy. You have friends. You have people help. Actually, somebody really does come to the door, but they stay there. They don't come in until you get your dog to stop barking. You might have to say enough 10 times with one visitor in one session, but that's okay. Every time he barks, you say enough, he gets a treat for stopping. So get started on that, and when you get to sort of the middle, then give us a call back, and we'll get you to phase three.
Okay, thank you. That's excellent advice. I can't wait to try it.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, Patricia, we learned today about what rats know and discriminating behavior. We heard about elephants and their behavior. But the rats and the elephants reminded me of mice and elephants. And, you know, there was an old saw about, and I don't know if it is an old saw, about elephants being afraid of mice.
And where did that come from?
Where did that come
from? You're going to ask me that, aren't you? And the answer is, I don't know. But you know what? I'll bet one of our listeners does. And one of our listeners, anybody knows, this is a great question. If somebody knows where the elephants are afraid of mice story comes from, send us an email. Send it to pets@wpr.org.
And we'll thank you very much. And Patricia, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. We'll do this again next week. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster, and Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.